Shall we go ahead and get started? Good afternoon, everyone. This is still going to be a formal recorded rulemaking hearing, but the microphones in the room do not work, thanks to water damage that we sustained last week. But everything else, I think, is working. So I'll try to speak up, since the voices won't be amplified. Everything is being recorded and broadcast over the internet. So, for the sake of the preliminary, since it's a formal hearing, my name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm conducting this rulemaking hearing on behalf of Bernie Busher, Secretary of State. The date is June 15th, 2010. The time is 2:04 p.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room on the second floor of the Office of the Secretary of State at 1700 Broadway in Denver. And we are meeting in accordance with the notice of rulemaking that was published in the Colorado Register on May 25th. I think the notice was issued on May 14th, published on May 25th. By way of introductions, to my immediate left is Judd Choate, the Director of Elections for the Secretary of State. To my immediate right is Hillary Rudy, legal analyst with the Elections Division. To my far right is Andrea Geiger, legal specialist with the Elections Division. In the course of receiving public comment today, they may have comments or questions, because I rely on their expertise with respect to these rules. So they will help me out here, I think. The primary purpose is to receive public comment on proposed rules. There's quite a lengthy set of proposed rules for a variety of reasons. Some of them relate to legislation, implementing legislation, such as House Bill 1116, the elections cleanup bill. There's subjects covered such as recount procedures, ballot counting standards, voter registration applications, verification of provisional ballots, and just various technical corrections and clarifications. I'm not going to go through them one by one, as I sometimes do for the record, but probably everyone has seen the revised statement of basis and purpose, which should be on the table. And to some degree, there's a quick summary of what the various proposed rule changes are intended to cover. There is one thing that I think I want to elaborate on a little bit, and relates primarily to proposed changes to 27.4.2, dealing with central count optical scan procedures. One of the things that we noticed from some of the written comments that we've already received is perhaps we weren't very clear on what we thought we were doing. I think it looked like we were proposing a new procedure for individually reviewing ballots, an extra step at the front end, when in fact our intent really was to do what most counties are apparently doing as a best practice anyway, is sort of an initial visual inspection to identify the damaged ballots and set them aside for purposes of duplication. So we've actually tried to take a run at maybe restating that a little bit to try to be clearer. Again, we got some comments that this was just an impossibly burdensome requirement when in fact we thought we were putting into rule what we think most counties do anyway. So there, on the table, there is a revised version. This is a possible alternative language to Rule 27.4.2. Strike some of the proposed language and instead would say a visual inspection of every ballot should be completed for the limited purpose of separating damaged ballots into a unique batch. And then every damaged ballot and all ballots sorted by the optical scan machine shall be resolved and duplicated in accordance with this rule. So I'm hoping that would alleviate some of the concern that we might have caused by maybe misstating what our intent was. But I'll find out perhaps from some public comment. What I will probably end up doing after receiving public comment is leave the rulemaking record open until the close of business on Friday. So I would encourage people who have the opportunity to provide additional written comments, whether people are listening over the internet or people that are present today, because we really do find those helpful. After we have a rulemaking hearing and have received written comments, we end up usually having a series of internal meetings to try to digest the comments that we get, and it's especially valuable to have the written comments, and especially valuable to have alternative language that really helps us understand the comments and be sure that we're doing the best job that we can on our end. So with that, if I've covered the preliminaries, I'd like to turn to public comment. A number of people have signed up to testify. So some of them just said perhaps they would testify, so we'll find out as we go along. I think it probably in order of the way people signed up. Faith Gross. Good afternoon. And as you come forward, identify who you are for the record and who you represent, if anyone. Faith.
Thank you. So the mic is not working?
It's not working in the room, but it is recording and broadcasting.
Okay. Thank you. Faith Gross, representing the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People, where I coordinate our statewide voting accessibility program. And my remarks are going to be limited to Rule 7.7 and also Rule 12.10.1. When I saw Rule 7.7 last week, it made my whole month. So I just want to tell you how pleased I am to see this new rule. It formalizes a process that we have been, our office in partnership with your office, we have been doing this work. It will facilitate us doing more of this work. We still have, as I've testified many times, more work to do statewide to bring the county clerk's offices into ADA compliance. So I'm very, very pleased, and I don't have a single recommendation for a change. I think it's excellent the way it's written, and I also believe that it gives us some of the strongest rules in the country around polling place accessibility. I've just come from our National Association's annual conference last week, and I'm not aware of any other state that has such good language in their rules regarding polling place accessibility. I will tell you that some of our sister agencies around the country have started filing lawsuits specific to polling place access, and I'm really pleased that here in Colorado we're not to that point and don't feel that we need to be at that point yet. Just a brief explanation for Rule 12.10.1, which reflects a law that was passed this last session requiring people-first language in state statutes. So I'm very pleased to see that you've extended that into the rules. And I just wanted to explain to people why people first language is so important for members of the disability community. The way we treat people is often the way based on the way we label or how we refer to people. And so we like to say that having a disability is just one characteristic of who a person with a disability is, and that they're people first, and so we'd like to see people first language, so I appreciate that change in the rules as well. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions? Yeah. Thank you, Faith.
Thank you.
Okay. Nancy Doty. I'm going through my yeses first. I'll come back to my perhapses, okay? Good afternoon, Nancy.
Good afternoon, everyone. I am Nancy Doty, Arapahoe County Clerk and Recorder. It's good to be here to have this opportunity to address a couple of the rules that we have concerns about. And the first one is Rule 7.72. And the second one will be 26.4.9. So, first one has to do with polling place accessibility. And the new rule would require the counties to do actual surveys on site for all of the polling locations. And the rule states annually. So if you were to mean that should just be done during a polling site election, then I would suggest that you clarify that to make that clear. Because we're thinking even during a mail ballot election, that might be required. So our issue is that we have about 200 polling locations, and we actually have conducted on-site surveys for all of our locations in 08. This year, we've already mailed letters to all of our nearly 200 locations and asked specifically if they've had any physical changes, such as, I have that written down, you know, the walkways, the doors, the bathrooms, all that sort of thing, in a letter to them. And we've received about 150 surveys back, and only 15 of those indicated they had any changes to the location. I've also attached to our documentation a sample of the letter that we sent out, plus the survey that we've completed in the past. So to conduct an on-site survey for our 200 polling locations and have that done prior to 100 days before the election, we would have to complete that by July 25th. And that would be very work intensive for our office right now because we're preparing for the primary. So an alternative, we're suggesting that you give the counties an option of contacting the facility in writing and asking for any changes that have occurred since the last one, or allowing the counties to go out and do a physical survey, and that would be fine. But of course, for those that have had a change, then we would go out and conduct a survey. We would suggest that we do a physical survey once every 4 years, perhaps. So it wouldn't be every general election. Then Rule 26.4.9 has to do with looking at provisional ballots and notifying an elector or a voter if they have not provided ID, as in the poll book required, ID required in the poll book. Now in 08, we received, we had about 6,300 people vote provisional ballots. And that's a large number to get through in 2 days and actually look and see if it was required for that voter to present identification. So we don't think it's feasible for us to get through that large number of provisional ballots in such a short period of time. So we're suggesting two things. First, that on the provisional ballot, there be a little addition there, a checkbox that the poll worker could identify those voters which would need identification, ID required, and that would be on the poll book so they could see that. Because in 08, we only had six people out of our 6,300 people that required ID and didn't have it. A lot of people come into the polls and they don't have identification, but they forgot it. But those people are not in this category from what we understand. They just merely forgot to bring their ID. They have voted before. We can verify their eligibility. But for those six, they were supposed to bring identification and didn't. In 06, we only had two people in over 4,000 provisional ballots. So if we could put on the provisional ballot envelope a little section, a little checkbox for the judge to put in there that they were to present identification, they didn't. They needed to vote a provisional ballot. That would help us. We could thumb through all these provisional ballots quickly. Otherwise, we'd have to pull up all of these records and score, and it would be very time-consuming. For smaller counties, it's not an issue, but I know that for the larger counties, it's a huge issue. And then we would also ask that perhaps you consider extending this for 3 days rather than the two, because there's so much going on right after the election that we need to do. That I don't know if we can feasibly complete it in 2 days. You have any questions?
Good. Any questions?
No.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Okay. And then
maybe a question.
Okay. One thing. Did you bring written comments by any chance?
Did I have that?
Great.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm back to my perhapses then. Jack Arrowsmith, do you want to testify?
I'd like to.
Okay. Okay. Hillary Hall.
Afternoon, Hillary Hall, Boulder County Clerk and Recorder. The first rule we wanted some clarification on was Rule 7, 7.1. We were wondering if there was an intentional reason why early voting locations were left out of that, and thought that it should be included as well. 7.7.2, our first comment on A would be, if we could get the 100 days to actually match the 90 days that currently exists for finalizing polling locations. Therefore, you're doing all the same process all at one time and submitting it at the 90-day mark instead of having two separate deadlines, unless there was an intentional reason why that was separated. So that's the comments on Rule 7.
I guess this is Hillary. I would like a little clarification. You know, one of the reasons we were looking at 100 days is because the statute does say you survey the location before you designate it.
Mm-hmm.
So are you saying that you would then submit both your designated locations along with the surveys for those locations?
Yes, as part of the process of here's our official locations.
Okay.
And that in order for it to be an official location, that would be part of the process for it.
Okay. And is it just a filing convenience? Is that why you don't want that extra 10-day buffer there?
I think we just think they should match
is
more the difference. And we always like more time than less. So our comment on that one. Then on B, similar to the comments from Clerk Doty, that to find a way so that polling locations that you've already used, you're not doing a physical inspection of every year. Again, like we were suggesting similar, like either with a letter stipulating or in the contract that you have with them stipulating that no construction has taken place, and then saving your site inspections for places where construction or it's a new location to limit the number of locations that you need to view. And we didn't put it in, but we do like the idea of perhaps it's every 4 years, every presidential year, you do go out and actually do a survey just to make sure you're still there. And then I think the other thing would be if a complaint was filed about a location, that might also be one that you would go and take a look at to make, regardless of how it was resolved, just to ensure that the issue had been addressed. So
if there was a report of construction or a complaint, but limit it to triggering events like
that. Right, new construction or complaint would be the scenarios where you would go out in the next polling place election that you'd be having, because some conduct their off-year elections as polling locations. Most of the metro counties don't, but I think if you're doing a polling place location, regardless of what year it is, you would go and check those ones out to ensure that they were in compliance.
Okay.
And then,
I have a question on that. Is there any concern at all that sometimes the actual construction is not a construction of the facility? So let's say you were at a school and you did your polling place was at a school, but the actual construction, which may affect the compliance of that location, is something that happened on the street or in the parking lot or something that's unrelated to the actual facility. I mean, is there any concern at all that you're not catching those if you're doing them every 4 years as opposed to every year?
Well, we saw the construction including the parking lot. I mean, the parts that they could control. The other thing, we are using public, majority of polling locations are in public buildings, and so there's already quite a bit that is required when construction and that sort of thing takes place. So, we, and again, we're, you know, it's very metro area focused, so we feel that it would be covered under that. Because again, what we're trying to find is a balance of when do you need to go and inspect, and when can, if nothing's changed, why would you need to go look at it again?
Okay.
So, but again, because we have the same issue, we want to make sure we address any concerns in that way, and maybe you could broaden it, but I think construction on the building and physical grounds would be. We would want that. We would want to go ensure that nothing had changed.
Thank you.
Okay, so now we have more.
Okay,
Rule 14.
Yes.
And we looked at it a bit, but really getting Rule 14 and Rule 27 to be consistent with each other, there's some areas where, you know, 14.6 is kind of mixing precinct and central count procedures into one section. 14.7 is really specific to the Ballot Now system. It's kind of sorting out which pieces, because we thought the point was to have those kind of match up, 14.4. But if we're making a false assumption, then let us know on that. That's an overall comment of Rule 14. Specific, so 14.7.1b, it talks about physically labeling each ballot as a recount. We would much prefer to be able to label the ballot box. So you would take a batch, scan it, and put it and lock it and secure it in a ballot box labeled recount, as opposed to stamping each ballot. In addition, specifically for the HART system, we would really want to rerun our batches. I think this is where we do have four different systems, and sometimes trying to write a rule that works for four different systems doesn't take advantage of the technology that exists for that particular system. So for the HART system, we would want to be run all of the batches in order to ensure that no ballot got missed, and do with our tally reports and also our audit processes, we can tell if there's any differences with any of the batches, and then just be able to store those in a new, so basically you transfer it to a new box and label that box recount, as opposed to have the manual process of stamping all of those ballots as recount. But I understand the intent is to make sure you don't miss any of them. You know what pile you're, what ballots you're working with. Sure. Okay. So then 14.7.3, we think that for B, to actually move the sentence, use the audit trail report and original scan patch report notes, and move that to go with the process of E. Because what we are, in our mind, the picture is you're trying to ensure the process that you used worked, and you would go through the resolution process with that batch. Then when you go to compare the results, if they were different, you would want to look at your audit trail to figure out what the difference was on them. Like, why was it different? Was it a manual resolution process? And again, this is with the HART system, because we have a visual way and a digital way to resolve our ballots. You don't duplicate a ballot in order to account for an overcount or an undervote. You do it with the system. And so for us, having that at the end is what makes more sense. And my sense is that a lot of this rule was written for the more traditional optical scan systems, and it doesn't really take into account the technology advances or technology differences that the HART system has.
And just to clarify, where would you like it?
So to go from, move it from B and put it as part of E, where you're actually comparing the recount results to the original results and documenting any differences using the audit trail and report batch scans to see why was there a difference, as opposed to, because the way we interpreted that was, if you used it as part of how you were counting, wouldn't it make the results the same no matter what, and you could repeat the same mistake, right? Because what you're really trying to do is recount and make sure that it was caught. Does that kind of make sense? At least with our processes. So that's Rule 14. Moving on to Rule 26. So, just to start with our premise, which was it seems like the intent of this rule is to use a similar process that we use for mail ballots when no ID is provided, for those that are required to provide ID. That kind of seemed like taking that process and then now adding it to provisional ballots. We have a couple of concerns. The first is, by doing that, it appears that we are skipping the process where we then verify that the voter is actually the voter who voted that ballot. Because what's, right, so if you're not checking an ID and you're not checking a signature, how are you verifying that that is in fact the same voter? Are you waiting for the ID to come back? Is that, that's the check on that. Okay. Just wanted to clarify that. But it, at the time, you know, you're not, what you have in front of you, you're not actually verifying them. So we just weren't sure if that was a good idea or not. You are waiting for the ID to come back, but you still have, right, you're not, you don't know who sent back the ID, right? You have a ballot, and you don't have ID to begin with. They sign it, but you're never checking that signature. You send out a letter, and somebody sends back an ID. If the ID matches, then you're saying that's the person who voted that ballot. Is that secure enough, is our question.
Yeah. So. Do you have a suggestion on, I mean, what's a better way to do it?
That we're still trying to, why are we trying to extend this privilege to people, to this group? We didn't understand that, and that might be a way that we would have a suggestion. Because the other part is that we're then also concerned with this process, just because of the time issue, similar to what Arapahoe County was stating to you, that when this process happens during a mail-in or a mail ballot, we have SCORE to do a lot of the work for us. And some of it is finding these and verifying these and then conveniently creating a list to do a mail merge letter with and getting that done. Again, we had in 2006, we had 3,000 provisional ballots, so getting through those and finding these in that time period. And in 2008, we had 1,500 ones. One of the ideas was if there's some way, either highlight or mark or stamp the provisional ballot so that you know right away, so that would make a quicker sorting process to some way allow a mark. Checkbox may work. I think we would want something bigger so you could go faster with it. Or maybe you leave that up to the county. Well, I guess you can't leave that up to the county. Affidavit. And also, if this goes into effect for this election, those are already, most people have already ordered their provisional ballots for both the primary and the general. So some way to mark that envelope as recommended. That's all we have for Rule 26. I also like the 3 days. We didn't think of that, but we like that. Second that. Mm-hmm. We like that idea as well. Oh, sorry, wrong procedures. All right. Good on any other? Okay. So Rule 27. This, again, is where I think the way you were trying to rewrite that helps, but then it also gets into utilizing a system and processes, whereas if we can shift to the outcome is to account for them, and counties currently have different methods for doing that. Some counties have a tracking system, and by keeping them in the original batch from, especially from either from a precinct or from opening, you can keep that number consistent. Other counties have a more, and I brought an example, have a tracking sheet to show when something moves out of a batch. So by focusing on the process as opposed to the outcome, it sometimes won't. That would be a lot to adapt to, depending on the counties and how they do it. The outcome is to make sure that none of the ballots, that you know which ballots were your damaged ballots, and that they're accounted for and tracked, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. And that counties have different systems, and so by prescribing them to either be in a separate batch for some counties, that's not their current process, and for other counties that does work, but they don't. In a traditional optical scan system, you have to sort out a lot more ballots to duplicate. In the HART system, it's really just ballots you can't get through the scanner. All the other ballots you resolve on a screen with a bipartisan resolution team, which saves you the step of having to make an extra ballot and have that tracking. You're keeping it with the ballot, and then if you need to review anything, you have the audit logs to go with it. So. No, I don't have a suggestion of how you write that, because that's one of the, as you know, one of the challenges is that there are four different systems, and you can sometimes write a rule that impacts, you know, for instance, the HART counties in a way very differently from the other systems. So that makes sense.
So I understand the process about using the verification log. I guess my question is if we found ourselves in a situation where we had to do a recount in, say, a highly contested presidential election, then is it feasible to go back to those and verify the process from A to Z in the short time frame we would have?
Yeah, it is. And because with those logs and the way with ballot now, again, I'm speaking just to the HART system, you can go back and you know exactly which batch it is and how that ballot was resolved with the resolution team matching those up.
And which batch, meaning which they scanning, are in a separate batch?
No, they're part which
they're
scanning
part of an
original
existing
scan batch.
Okay.
Is. And the reason we try to keep as much of a batch together is when you're accounting and match, every time you move a ballot up, you lessen your chance of your numbers adding back up at the end.
Right.
So you try to remove as few ballots as possible in order to keep that integrity from signature verification all the way through scanning and from precinct, because you get your totals of how many ballots came from each precinct all the way through. So at least that's the premise with a lot of count. Well, so. And again, I think that the new rule addresses some of this. I haven't really, having just seen it, I'm not quite sure how that plays out. So for 27.4.2, I kind of basically that, again, it sorting out damaged ballots and duplicating them takes away the technology advantage that the HART system has. The more ballots we can leave in the batch and use the resolution teams for, the more effective and faster we can go with our system.
So, but in the case of a damaged ballot, they're pulled from the batch.
If it's a damaged ballot that like can't go through the or would damage the scanner, it's
right.
pulled from the batch. In our county, we actually put a tracking number on it, and we write which batch it originally came from, and then we match those up.
So they're not reinserted back into the batch.
No, that would be one example where it is actually duplicated, and I guess it's still the definition of damage still seems broad, maybe, and is if damage because in other systems, so like we can resolve. Undervotes, we could resolve. Overvotes, stray marks, material that really shouldn't have been used, like they don't fill in the bubble. We, you know, those are the ones we give extra examination to make sure that they were marked correctly. But we don't need to make a new ballot in order for our system to do that. And that's, again, just the difference of the systems.
So I'll speak on behalf of, my participation in those. It seemed to me, from sort of the lawyer point of view, trying to defend the state in a situation like this, that where all of the ballots were treated similarly, you know, where if you had to do a special examination or a duplication of a ballot, where all those were put into one slot or into a special batch or whatever your strategy is for dealing with those, it seems like that's a way that's more defensible from a state perspective. How does it sounds to me like you're suggesting that based on the differences in technology across counties, that's not an easy thing to do, and thus we're sort of in the quagmire of trying to defend various different ways in which counties do that process.
And I guess I would say, what is it that goes into that? What I think is defining what does damage mean? What goes into that? Is that overvotes? Is that, you know, is that blank ballots? Is that, you know, what exactly goes into that pile? And this again is where processes are different, because in our county, anything where the voter didn't follow the instructions, it starts out in its original batch for accounting purposes, and then when it goes through, we have a tracking system which I'm happy to show you guys that when it goes through the scanner. Then we remove, because we want it accounted for, right? We want to show that it came from the scanning room in its batch and made it from the opening room or the pre-sort where the precinct room is, and that it made it to the scanner. And then at the point of scanning, if there's a question, we want it accounted for, and then it goes into its own batch in our county. And that's where it gets tricky, is again, to be as efficient as possible. And then those are the ones that you make sure worked correctly. So, and then I'll let, trying to speak more generally to others who do it slightly differently, and that's where you get yourself into trouble of that. So.
And, you know, just to comment, one of the things that I think underlies this that relates to Judd's comment is that we've sort of been thinking a lot since the recount in the Minnesota U.S. Senate race, and that actually underlies some of the things that you see here that Judd referred to. There's sometimes maybe a tension between what's most efficient and the best practice in counting ballots. And then if you flash forward to a highly contested, highly lawyered recount, what's going to be most efficient then? And so as long as we can, you know, you don't want to be in that situation, but we know we have to prepare for that as well.
Right, and I guess I would lobby for not using to use a less effective method because you can do it consistently. I mean, then there's also a balance there as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
I have them in writing, but I had some more additions.
Okay, good. Thanks. Jack, do you want to comment?
I might add a comment or two.
Okay.
Jack Arrowsmith, Clerk and Recorder, Douglas County, and I want to say that we agree with about 99.9% of what Hillary just said. Her comments were brilliant in those areas. We do in Douglas County do things a little bit different. One, when we get a damaged ballot, our process has been thus far to duplicate that ballot, but to keep the ballot with the batch. Again, one of the things that puts an election at risk is balancing to make sure that those ballots are tracked from beginning to end. So our process has to put that ballot at the top of the batch so it's easily identified and we can electronically identify where that ballot is, but to keep it part of the batch. So it's a little bit different than what Boulder County does. Again, our concern and vision was balancing. One of the things that we saw in Minnesota was that the ballots were being moved from a county to a central count and then to a Supreme Court SOS location. I would hope that in Colorado that's not necessarily the case, that we're moving ballots from one area to another and that we're allowing the recount to take place in the county under maybe SOS observation or whatever, but I think our recount process in Colorado will look different than it did in Minnesota just because of rules and so forth. So keep in mind that the process and procedures that a county has is probably safer not to move those ballots, that everybody is secure in a process that they've worked up over a period of time. One of the problems, and I agree with Hillary exactly, is how do you talk to a rule that involves multiple vendors and the process may look differently. Certainly, Douglas County in 06 purchased Hart because of the electronic resolution purpose. You know, that was one of the reasons that we chose that particular technology, because that was certainly attractive to us. And I would say that the other 46, 45 counties that use Hart, that may have been in part of the mix as to why they did that. So it's problematic, in my opinion, not to be able to use the technology that's there. One suggestion might be that if we're going to move forward with rulemaking, that individual counties could apply with a procedure that maybe electronically accounted for the procedure that you're asking for in rulemaking, so kind of an option to use a different path rather than trying to write many, many rules to account for every circumstance. That might be a possibility of getting to the same point without writing lots of rules. What did I miss? Questions?
Thank you very much. Jack?
Sherry?
Jenny Flanagan.
Good afternoon. Jenny Flanagan, Common Cause.
Sorry, I wrote no and should have written perhaps. Of course, I was thinking perhaps, but how could I come to a rulemaking and not make some comment? Jenny Flanagan with Colorado Common Cause. I just had two comments based on the discussion. First, in terms of Rule 7, in terms of the accessibility requirements, I certainly defer to my colleague Faith Gross at the Legal Center, but we believe it does make sense to do in the annual assessments. I understand and I hear the burdensome requirements, but relying only on the building or facilities managers and not seeing it for ourselves as, and when I say ourselves, the county officials, people who run our elections, the training and sort of the understanding of the requirements that the ADA puts forward in terms of polling place accessibility seems better suited for the county election official rather than a building manager, perhaps. And other features may change, like sidewalks or other kinds of damage. You know, again, this isn't my area of expertise, but it does seem to just make sense as the rule is currently laid out. So we do support it in that fashion. I wanted to also note around the provisional ballots that require ID, I thought that County Clerk from Arapahoe County yesterday agree with that suggestion. I might stay away from the term checkbox on a form, but I think having some way to note that this particular voter was ID deficient and required ID for that provisional ballot would ease the burden for the counties and also make clear that if the voter has already provided ID and is otherwise eligible and can be verified, that we should be able to process those voters as quickly as possible. So we think that would be the best outcome and support those changes. We don't oppose moving it to 3 days if that would be an easier process for the county clerks. We do think it's important, though, for voters who are tagged as ID deficient to get that opportunity to provide identification. It seems a reasonable opportunity and a letter or other communication that would facilitate that voter who is otherwise eligible to have their ballot counted just makes sense and certainly is in the best interest for voters of Colorado. So thank you.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much, Jenny. Anyone else wish to testify? Oh, Faith?
Thank you. Faith Gross again, representing the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People. And I do want to address the concerns raised by Clerks Stody and Hall and just elaborate a little bit on what Ms. Flanagan just testified to. The reason why we support annual surveys of the proposed or designated polling places, and I would think that in a all-male election, you would only be surveying, required to survey those that are going to actually be polling places, not your precinct polling places, but your voter service centers. First of all, in 20 years of doing ADA work, I have learned never to trust the building facility managers or other types of managers of buildings and facilities when they say, oh, yes, we are fully ADA compliant. In my experience, which has been pretty broad around the state, that's rarely the case. So that's the first concern. And since election officials are going to be the ones ultimately responsible for providing fully ADA compliant polling places, I think it's prudent to ensure that for yourselves. As Ms. Flanagan said, there is a requirement for maintenance, what we call maintenance of effort, and maintaining accessible features. And so while it's highly unlikely that there would be construction and maybe the width of a doorway would change or the slope of a ramp would change, what does change, particularly in our climate in Colorado, is the pavement oftentimes becomes damaged from year to year. Anybody driving around in Denver right now is, or anywhere in the state, is dealing with potholes that maybe weren't there last week, but after all this rain, are there this week. And certainly with the snow that we get and then the temperature extremes. So sidewalks do crack, buckle, break, disintegrate. Trees, which can have hanging limbs, grow, and shrubs, and those pose hazards, particularly to voters who are blind or visually impaired, but also for voters who have mobility disabilities. So it really is important every year when you are going to be holding an election in a particular polling place to go out and take a look at it? Does it have to be a thorough answer, check every box on the survey form? Maybe not. But those features that could change really do need to be evaluated every year. The other issue is that a lot of the non-public buildings, we're looking at temporary barrier removal. So temporary solutions, which are often cones and temporary signage. And you really do need to have a very clear-cut plan, and that could change from year to year. So I'm going to continue to support annual surveys of any polling place that will be used in that year's election. Also want to point out that we are coming up on the 20th anniversary of the signing of the ADA. That will be 5 weeks and 6 days from today. We're already starting to celebrate in the disability community, but we also know that we have a long ways to go, including most of our public courthouses, our county courthouses, still need a lot of work in this state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Question?
Thank you very much. Dave?
Oh. Amber?
Good afternoon. I didn't sign up on there. I was running a little late. We just have a couple quick items. On Rule 2.8 and 13.18, you have in here a PDF attachment to an email. And there's actually many methods in which that could come, a JPEG or any sort of other attachment. So I wasn't sure if you meant to do that, or you may want to clarify that particular statement in both of those rules. And then also on Rule 7.7.2B, which is what I know a lot of the people in this room have testified on, we have a couple of immediate concerns with regards to the timing for this year. We have resurveyed some of our polling sites that needed additional work for this particular year, but we haven't done all of them. And to get that done by July, towards the end of July, is there is a timing issue there, and there's a cost issue there, because that's something that we haven't planned for. So I agree with some of the proposals that Clerk Doty mentioned with regards to this year, and maybe would ask for some sort of, you know, I don't mind going forward, but a rule like this coming into play in the middle of June is a bit burdensome. And we would support annual surveys as long as it was meant for just sites that are going to be used in that particular year. We wouldn't want to have to resurvey all of the polling places each year if we weren't using all of them for that particular year. We also wanted a clarification when you say every year, is that calendar year? Is that, you know, what's kind of the timing in there? Because if we do all of our surveys right now, would that last us until next July? Because we have actually another May election next year that'll probably be a polling place election. So what would be the timing on that? And again, we appreciate all the testimony put forth so far. And also, obviously, we always defer to Faith as our ADA expert, so I certainly appreciate the concerns that she raised. But we just have to figure out a kind of a balance between what's doable at the county level and what's practical. So, thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Anyone else wish to testify at this time? If not, then we'll close the hearing. Again, I'll leave the record open until close of business on Friday, 5 o'clock on Friday. Would love to see additional written comments. The easiest way to do that is to submit them by email to Andrea Geiger. And her email address is andrea.geiger. And that's G-Y-G-E-R, andrea.geiger@sos.state.co.us. If there's nothing else, then at 2:53 p.m., we're adjourned. And thank you for coming.